Good afternoon. My name is Angel, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Trust Company quarterly investment call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. If you should need assistance during the call, please press star zero on your telephone keypad, and an operator will come back to assist you. Thank you. You may begin your conference.
Thank you for joining the Trust Company's quarterly investment call. As a reminder, information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities product, service, or investment strategy. Investments involve risk, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with your qualified financial advisor, tax professional, or attorney before implementing any strategy or recommendation discussed during this call. And now I will pass this to our host.
Good afternoon. My name is Ian Bruch, Portfolio Manager of the Naples Trust Company. With me today, as always, is my colleague Timothy Vick, Senior Portfolio Manager here with me in Naples as well. On behalf of the entire staff across our Sanibel, Captiva, Naples, and Tampa Bay offices, we thank you for participating in our quarterly conference call for clients and guests. The format today will begin with Tim making a few remarks, followed by the two of us answering questions, which many of you provided over the past few weeks. We will answer as many questions as possible and will contact directly those of you whose questions we could not address during today's call. Out of respect for your time, our call will span 30 minutes and end promptly at 4:30. With all that said, Tim, you want to go ahead?
Thanks, Ian. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us. I want to start by making a few observations before we move to your questions. I remember back in April, a client was asking me if I had any predictions for 2016, and half seriously, I bet him that the Chicago Cubs would get to the World Series before Donald Trump would ever win the White House. And I continued to offer that bet to others during the year, and I didn't get any takers. I think a lot of people in retrospect knew that this would be a year of surprises and of unpredictability and a year of some long shots coming in. Now, I've seen and know that many investors still crave last-minute predictions regarding the election, and I promise we'll give you our take on the situation in a few minutes. But the thing I will say is that we are not sitting on the edge of our seats, nor are we ready to pull some trigger depending on who takes the White House or Congress tomorrow. Why? I think it's simple. Fear and outrage are not investment strategies. Let me repeat that. Fear and outrage are not investment strategies. You should never change your long-term financial plan simply because of an election result. Never. It will almost always backfire on you down the road. Now, I know our industry pretty well, and I think starting early Wednesday morning, the strategists will come out of the woodwork. They'll start showing up in the media. They'll serve up a lot of scary new narratives with new products and new strategies they say are going to better position you for the future. And just keep in mind that a lot of the financial industry exists to sell you something, and the media exists simply for ratings. Come election time, these two industries combine in a very toxic way to scare you into making changes. The best advice we can always give you is to invest based on probable long-term outcomes, not on possible short-term outcomes. We've learned that anything is possible. A war, a hurricane, a recession, a nuclear accident, a terrorist attack. But the likelihood of these things happening in a given week or a month are very low. So low that you can do long-term harm to your portfolio constantly trying to protect yourself from events like this. So that's why we bet on probable outcomes. Well, here's what we know. I mean, first, the stock market is actually behaving very rationally this year, but only if you focus on the bigger picture. 2016 began with investors living in fear that China and its Asian trading partners were heading toward a hard landing. And that started investors selling growth stocks around the world and chasing defensive stocks. And that was a natural reaction. Slower economic growth tends to lead to lower corporate sales and lower interest rates, and that tends to lead investors to chase high-yielding stocks. So from that perspective, 2016 has been a largely predictable year. Stocks of electric utilities, we've noticed, were outperforming growth stock indexes through the end of October. And Johnson & Johnson was the single biggest contributor to gains in the S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials this year, and I think that's the first time that's happened since about 1971. The second thing to remember is that corporate earnings are the biggest driver of stock market performance, not politics, not the euro, not Brexit, but earnings. If you ask us how the stock market is going to perform under Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, we're going to throw up our hands in the air. It's unpredictable. If you ask us instead how the stock market is going to perform over the next 5 years if economic growth averages 3% or if corporate earnings rise, say, 6% a year, we can give you pretty reasonable answers that likely are going to be close to reality. And that certainly has been the case through 2015 and 2016, years that were quite predictable in retrospect. Last year, profits for the S&P 500 companies were virtually flat, and so was the stock market. In 2016, earnings are slowly rebounding, and so is the stock market. For the time being, corporate profits and economic growth remain subdued, and we've been saying that for months, and they're running way below historical averages. So for that reason, we stay cautious. We continue to take fewer risks in portfolios, and we continue to upgrade the quality of portfolios where we can. Because we've experienced a market that has moved sideways for more than a year, we've been given the luxury of knowing that we can actively upgrade portfolios, knowing that the market is not going to run away from us. And if the market does want to correct because it doesn't like tomorrow's election results, we will take advantage. So with that, let's get to your questions, and it looks like we have a number of them. Ian, take it away.
Thanks, Tim. I'll get started here with our first question. Why are interest rates staying so low, and are you worried about the stock market when rates start rising again? I'll go ahead and take that one. I think clearly the market doesn't believe that the broader economy can support significantly higher rates at this point. We noticed that about 1 year ago when the Fed first lifted off and raised the federal funds rate by a quarter point. You saw markets trail off from there, and investors have really favored dividend-paying income securities through much of 2016. Let's also remember that the Fed really only controls the short end of the yield curve, and the market really weighs in on what interest rates are more broadly across the economy. We've seen interest rates move a bit higher over the past few months. I think that's just in anticipation of another move higher here later in December in about a month. I think also it's important to point out, frankly, no, we're not all that worried. Let's all remember what higher interest rates really imply. Usually, higher interest rates mean better economic growth, a better employment picture, rising inflation, which all tend to be good signs for the broader economy. The next question, where are oil prices likely to go, and what impact will they have on the economy? Well, I spent some time on this just in researching some of our oil companies and master limited partnerships that are in some of our dividend paying accounts and higher income accounts. And some of the more recent data points that have come out, inventory levels, I think they came out much higher than expected just about a week ago. That sent oil prices back down again into the mid-40s from where they were earlier in the low 50 range. And we'll continue to see data points that create some short-term volatility over the next several months. Another data point we've seen is that the rig count here domestically continues to increase as companies begin to feel more comfortable spending money at these marginally higher oil prices. I think, you know, we could probably be well into 2017 before we get some longer-term consensus on equilibrium oil. As a guide, since we don't make oil forecasts and we are hesitant to ascribe to any one price level because it's always a moving target, most economists, and it's supported by a lot of corporate capital expenditure budgets within the industry, seem to imply $60 to $70 oil is still sort of a run rate that most people are using, which I think is fine, and it's really supported by both consumers and companies. So I think both consumers can stomach filling up their gas tanks at that price level, and frankly, most exploration and production companies can earn a profit at that price level too. I would just caution anyone making too much of any news items that come out on OPEC and the Saudis and Iranians making a deal to limit production. That's been a news item that crops up every few months as they have their meetings, and everyone seems to think that that's going to put some sort of floor to oil production. I would caution anyone who believes that those two countries are going to come to sort of some sort of grand bargain and actually trust that the other one is going to do what they say. So I think that's much ado about nothing. I think the market will end up dictating where we end up in over the next several months in terms of oil. Tim, I'll ask this one to you. What are your thoughts on the election and how the stock market will react?
Well, thanks for punting on that one, Ian. I'm just looking at the rally today in the market, nearly 2% up. You can tell that the market spends considerable time and resources trying to handicap the election. It does matter to some extent. And we know that public policy, you know, whether it's changes in labor laws, tax rates, environmental regulations, bank regulations, defense spending, it can have a huge impact on specific companies and industries and make them more or less attractive as investments. And, you know, I promise you that starting tomorrow and for the next 4 years, we're going to be watching all these changes very closely, and we'll adapt portfolios around the edges if we have to. But, and here's where you have to draw the line. When you're talking big picture, there really is no correlation between politicians and the ongoing performance of the U.S. economy, and there is almost no correlation between who holds the White House and the performance of the stock market as a whole. The data are very clear on this. The two biggest contributors to U.S. economic growth tend to be productivity and population growth. If the population grows 1% a year and productivity grows 2% a year, the economy tends to grow roughly 3% a year, no matter who controls Washington. I think the research is also very, very clear that neither political party is automatically better for the stock market. I've seen a lot of studies over the past years that tout the fact that the stock market does better under a Democratic president, but you have to mine the data and see what's really happening. If you factor out 2 years during the Depression, that is the last year of Herbert Hoover when the stock market crashed, and the first year of Franklin Roosevelt when the market surged off its bottom, it's been a wash. It didn't matter who was holding office. The returns to investors were about the same. And the data also assume that our two political parties have pretty much kept the same platforms for the past 200 years, and they really haven't. You can look at a president like Lincoln, who ran as a Republican, but by today's standards would be a Democrat. Teddy Roosevelt, the same thing, was a Republican, and today's standards would make him probably a progressive liberal. And then you have Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, who ran as Democrats, and Jefferson, I think, was a Democratic Republican, whatever that means by today's standards. But, you know, today they would be independents. So their political party affiliations and their party platforms at the time really didn't matter. And that is the point. The data shows it hasn't mattered to people. The personalities in the White House, they really can't affect your long-term returns very much. But they can affect your returns if you react, and you react negatively. When investing, you have to take your cues from business, and that's what we do. The performance of business is the single biggest indicator of whether stocks are going to be rising or falling. So I would say, regardless of what happens tomorrow night, and regardless of what the doom and gloomers begin predicting, the sun is going to rise on Wednesday, consumers will keep going to the stores, companies will keep producing products for a profit, and frankly, we just don't see Washington upsetting or halting those forces.
Well, Tim, you mentioned taking your cues from business. I think this question gets to that point. We're seeing a lot of big mergers again. Is that a good signal for investors?
As a signal, I think it's a very positive one, for it tells us that companies are bullish about deploying their cash and their capital. They're seizing opportunities in their industries, and they are pretty much ignoring the situation in Washington, which I think is a good signal for all of us. I read a story last week that we've had more than 2,100 deals announced around the world since the beginning of 2014, in excess of $1 billion each. Now that is, if I do my math right, you know, well more than $1 trillion that has exchanged hands, that is shareholders were bought out, and more than $1 trillion was put back in the hands of the acquiring shareholders, and that's helped fuel this market, no doubt, and I think it's just buoyed the optimism of this market and allowed folks to redeploy capital in better types of ventures. There's a couple of mergers we're watching very closely right now because they impact companies that we're heavily invested in. It's AT&T buying Time Warner, which was announced about 2 weeks ago, and General Electric announcing it was going to merge with Baker Hughes' oil and gas business. These are mergers that reflect the optimism and the long-term bullishness of these corporations. And the interesting thing was they were announced right on the heels of a very controversial election. And that kind of tells us that if these companies whom we invest in are bullish and really are insensitive to who's running in Washington, I think the average investor should be as well, because it comes down to investing in companies that are bullish and are companies that are growing. And if companies don't feel that the game in Washington is going to impact their business model the next couple of years, I think that that's a good storyline for investors to follow as well.
Next question, I'll take a stab at this. If economic growth stalls, how will my portfolio perform? Well, I think, you know, obviously if economic growth does stall, I think much the same sorts of investments that have frankly performed well this year will continue to perform well. I think your defensive stocks, utilities, industrials, anything that pays a dividend or has an income stream tied to it. I'd say, you know, frankly, we're assuming economic growth globally will continue to be fairly modest. And so, you know, let's be honest, while it's not stalling, it's also not robust either. And all that means is that we don't have that extra tailwind in our client portfolios. So there's some years where, you know, you can make the less optimal investment decision and still do quite well because the economy is raging ahead and it's very difficult to lose money. We're not in that environment. I think good fundamental analysis, deciding what you want to own and why you want to own it for a long period of time is as important now as it's ever been. And I think clients can still make money in a market like this. They can still achieve their long-term goals by investing in individual companies that grow their revenue and earnings at a nice, modest clip. So if a company says that they're going to grow their revenue and earnings by 5 or 6, maybe 8 to 9% a year, broader economic growth matters a little bit less. What really matters is, are they achieving what they said they're going to achieve? And those results always come out every quarter, and we're in a position we can evaluate what they said a quarter ago, and are they meeting their estimates and continuing to perform as they said they would. And as long as they are, client portfolios can remain intact in these good long-term companies, and some of the short-term noise really starts mattering much less. The next question, if the Fed raises rates in December, won't stocks fall in price? How are we handling this? Yes, I think, you know, certainly we would expect some stocks to fall in price if the Fed raises rates. And we actually assume that the Fed will raise rates. The market seems to be implying that at this point. Dividend payers in particular will probably fall in price a bit. We've actually already seen some of this occur over the last month or two. Much of what worked well in the first half of 2016, we felt like got ahead of itself to some extent. You know, does it make sense that a boring dividend payer that's not growing their revenue and earnings much is up double digits in a six-month period of time? Probably not. However, on the same token, we would expect growth stocks to do quite well if interest rates do rise, because as dividend payers did quite well, growth stocks have underperformed. So if you didn't pay a dividend earlier in the year, you were sort of left out of the party. No one cared about you. But meanwhile, you're growing your revenue and earnings at a nice clip. There's no reason why your stock price shouldn't follow. And then lastly, I think I mentioned this earlier, but let's just all remind ourselves what rising interest rates actually mean. The Fed it's pretty definite that Janet Yellen makes moves based on data points. And if the data is saying that the market can accept higher rates, they're going to move rates higher. And at the point at which things seem a little uncertain, I would assume they're going to put the pause button on future interest rate increases. But again, let's remember what that all means. Rising interest rates means that you have an economy that supports higher rates. You have lower unemployment, modest inflation, which I think everyone would be willing to see a little bit more of. And frankly, if we were all sitting with higher interest rates across the board and the economy was moving on ahead, that we'd all be in a bit of a better position anyway. And lastly, we don't reposition accounts based on short-term changes in Fed policy. So dividend payers, growth stocks, bonds, they'll all survive the Fed's next interest rate move. And you have to some extent, ignore whatever occurs 1 to 2 trading days around some of these moves, because it's simply the market readjusting. But it's not a good time to change your long-term approach or make meaningful long-term strategy changes. Tim, here's another question. I keep reading about troubles with banks in the United States and Europe. Are you avoiding those sectors, or are there opportunities there?
Well, first, I think we have to segment the differences in the troubles between the European banks and the U.S. banks. They all got into the same predicament back in 2005, 2007, making a lot of poorly managed loans in the housing industry that came back to bite them, and then they were trading exotic derivative products that blew up in their faces. The United States banks have moved beyond that. Europe is still struggling to correct the balance sheet problems of 8 and 10 years ago because those banks were very overly levered, where it didn't take much in terms of loan losses to suddenly cripple their capital structure and force them to raise a lot of capital and bring about a host and series of political problems that all these countries collectively are trying to tackle right now. Our banks are far beyond that. The troubles we have right now are not related to the housing crisis anymore. It's the aftermath of the crisis, and the regulation and certainly some of the punishments that have been exacted from them is taking its toll on their earnings and their ability to grow in the future. And that's what kind of worries us and gets to this question of whether or not there are opportunities. You know, on the one hand, we don't see many opportunities in the banking industry because all the banks that I look at seem to be efficiently priced. The ones with the highest returns on equity and the highest returns on capital and are growing their earnings the quickest are the ones that price at the highest PE ratios. The ones that get the lowest returns on equity are trading beneath their book value. And everything looks pretty efficiently priced. There's no excess profits to be gained right now. Are they good long-term opportunities to be had in banking or even in Europe? I would say no. The industry has been half regulated to death by regulators both in the United States and Europe the last several years. The banks cannot obtain the returns on equity or returns on invested capital they could in the 1990s when they were swapping hands at 3x book value. And their growth rates are going to be stymied near term and perhaps longer term by the fact that interest rates are staying so low. They get very low profit margins on new loans that they're making. And those margins have been cut in half over the last 20 years to the point that banks have to rely on more and more outside forms of revenues and profits, you know, to meet the grade that, you know, analysts are expecting. And we've seen what can happen with some of these retail banks when they try to spin off too many new products and try to cross-sell these products. I'm not going to mention any names, but, you know, we had a portfolio stock that's been in our, you know, a significant banking holding for us for years. And because of the headlines that happened several weeks ago, we jettisoned that position. And we thought that was the best performing retail bank. But now we've come to the conclusion that the entire sector is handicapped, and therefore we can look elsewhere, and we think we can find better growth opportunities and better dividend payers, you know, elsewhere.
Great. What is causing all the price weakness with drug stocks? This is another topical industry. What do you like in the industry?
Well, I think the problems with the drug stocks this year is they've been a victim of their own success. There was a huge rally in biotechs and in drug companies starting 3 and 4 years ago, and I think valuations got a little stretched. We had just this surge of new activity of pipeline. A lot of new drugs came out into the market proclaiming, you know, that they were going to cure, you know, some major diseases, including like Hep C and such, and it just drove valuations almost sky high in a couple cases. You know, on top of that, the political pressure started mounting. It has started more than a year ago on the campaign trail, and then we've had investigations now into predatory pricing on the part of a few drug manufacturers initiated by members of Congress. There's been some questionable cross-border mergers where companies have tried to merge overseas and move their operations, and you know, the government had to step in and halt that type of activity. And I think there's also been attempts to rein in drug costs to make Obamacare losses more palatable to politicians. I mean, the combination of all those factors really just deadened that whole rally, and it just meant that it took a breather, and a lot of momentum investors and sector traders just moved on from the drug industry. The way we look at it is now an opportunity. We've held several medical-related stocks and portfolios. Some of them have done quite well, and some of them look like they're opportunities. Our favorites. I mean, we've got Johnson & Johnson in portfolios. I think that's been a stellar performer for us. They've picked up their unit volume growth overseas. We like what we're seeing out of the drug unit there. C.R. Bard is a company we put in our growth-oriented portfolio several months ago. This is a maker of medical and surgical devices. We've had Abbott and AbbVie in portfolios for a long period of time. We're actually holding on to Gilead, which has been part of this pricing issue. But longer term, we think we can find more opportunities. And, you know, to my original remarks, that if we see more sell-offs that have been induced by this election, I think we will take advantage of it.
Next question, if interest rates rise, will you begin buying bonds? I'll take a stab at this. In short, yes, but it's really a matter of scale. If the Fed raises another quarter point, even a few more times, we all have to acknowledge that we still have exceedingly low interest rates. We'd much rather own bonds after rates rise, and that's important. So we'd be purchasers after interest rates rise meaningfully, not before. When we do buy bonds today, it's really as a substitute for cash primarily, really to limit volatility, to help our clients sleep a little more soundly at night. It really doesn't fulfill most of our clients' total return expectations currently. So we're not carving out a place for bonds just because. It's really to limit volatility, to do something marginally higher than what cash can do in a client account. And when we are buying bonds, we're buying shorter to medium term maturities. Obviously, as you extend yourself out on the yield curve, that opportunity cost increases as well. So we're trying to stay shorter. Yes, that means we're earning a little bit lower interest rate on those bonds, but we'd rather be exposed to the bond market again if interest rates rise. And the way you do that is to avoid locking yourself into bonds for really long periods of time. And, you know, we've said this in client meetings with prospective clients and at our AMC meetings on Thursdays. We would love to be big buyers of bonds again in the future. You know, we have a lot of clients that live off of fixed incomes. They need a certain amount of money coming out of their portfolios every month to live off of. And bonds historically have been a really useful source for meeting those income needs. And we'd like to be able to achieve a significant majority of that through bonds once again. But, again, the market's giving us what it's giving us at this point. Interest rates have been exceedingly low for many years. It seems likely that we're stuck with lower rates for longer. So we'll just keep reevaluating as time goes on. Next question, what is your expectation for markets next year? Well, I'd say it's probably much the same as it was in 2014 and 2015, frankly. 2016, I think we all expected the markets would be modestly higher, mid-single digits, and through yesterday, I know we're getting a big move today, but through yesterday, markets were up about 4% on the year. That seems reasonable when you consider what the earnings growth has been for most multinational corporations. Given we think the markets are fairly valued, earnings growth going forward seems as good a guide as any toward future market performance, and so we'd say probably mid-single digits is most probable. Is our best guess going into next year as well. Tim, I think we have time for one last question. How do the earnings look for the companies we own so far?
Well, I think that dovetails nicely in the answer you just gave, Ian. So far, we've been pretty pleasantly surprised by all the companies we follow. And I say we follow because we don't own the market. So what's happening on a macro level of all 500 companies isn't always germane to what we're doing in individual client portfolios where maybe they only own 20 of those companies. It's been our goal to watch those 20 companies like a hawk and make sure they're performing to our expectations and can give you the returns you're looking for. And so far what we've seen in the second quarter and in this third quarter is that we're getting the results we've been looking for. You know, not only on the revenue front, but on the bottom line earnings front, and profit margins are coming in the way we want to, so these companies are doing what we expect. Now, the big issue is going to be, and has been, that when these companies are reporting earnings, particularly in the last month, they tend to sell off the day they report earnings, no matter what they were. And I think that's just a function of all the trading activity that occurs before the earnings announcement. And it may open up some opportunities, but by and large, it just confirms to us that we should keep holding the security. When I look at our industries, I've been pleased to see the way they've been showing bottom line growth. Our industrial companies are getting better volume growth finally, particularly overseas, where they're growing their sales at 2, 3, 4% when you adjust for the currencies. And they've been engaging in a lot of cost cutting. That's allowed them to improve their cash flows, beat their estimates on the bottom line, and generate a lot more free cash flow than they have in the past. That's a good sign. Our consumer stocks, our multinationals especially, have been benefiting from a dollar that is no longer appreciating against its other trading currencies. So that meant that this big headwind they faced in 2015 and early 2016 is all but dissipated, and these companies are going to start showing better results there. Our financial stocks, I think, have come in right with expectations. There were no great surprises out of the the banks and some of the other financial services companies. As I said before, we've shied away from the banks now, and we're looking at alternatives, companies like BlackRock for its dividend and its growth ability, companies like Visa and MasterCard on the credit side, and even Berkshire Hathaway is a multinational conglomerate. They're all coming in with expectations. And then our internet and information technology stocks, they're still showing growth well beyond GDP and well beyond their own competitors. So we've been real pleased in our growth portfolios to see companies like Google and Accenture and PayPal and Facebook all just beat the estimates and smash them in some cases. And that's what we're looking for. If those companies give us those types of results quarter after quarter, eventually their share prices are going to catch up.
Well, thanks, Tim, and thank you all again for making the time to join us today. This concludes our quarterly investment call. We hope you found this format to be both informative and useful. If today's discussion has generated additional thoughts or questions, as always, we welcome your call to address them directly. Thanks again for joining us, and have a nice afternoon.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.